This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina ranks among the top 10 states in the U.S. for sex trafficking. We don't know the exact numbers for this invisible crime, but we know that the highway system, the transient military population, and the ports all contribute to sex trafficking's prevalence in this state. Beginning October 1st, two new laws will impose harsher punishments on sex trafficking offenders. Lindsay Robertson is an assistant district attorney in New Hanover County, and she helped draft both laws. Lindsay, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Sheila Simpkins is a sex trafficking survivor. She now works at Magdalen, a recovery program in Nashville for sex trafficking victims. She's also an intervention specialist at End Slavery, Tennessee. Sheila Simpkins, welcome.
Thank you.
How did you become involved, Sheila, in sex trafficking?
Well, it actually kind of started whenever I was 6 years old and my mom would bring men into the house and I would do oral sex for them while she was in the bed with me. And so, in a sense, I was kind of conditioned at a young age to think that it was okay to be doing sexual performances on men. And so whenever I ran away at 14 and I got this guy who I thought was my boyfriend and I started selling myself to take care of both of us. It almost seemed, it was like it was natural.
And when you ran away, nobody looked for you. Is that right?
No, I was kind of like what we call a throwaway, where you don't really, where your mother doesn't report you to the police as being gone.
You were in the foster care system?
Well, no, actually what ended up happening is I kind of went... I got into a little bit of trouble, went to juvenile hall, and after I told them what was going on, they put me into a foster home, and I ran away from the foster home. I kind of felt like I was being punished for stuff that my mom had allowed to happen. At that time in my life, I didn't realize that it was they were actually helping me, and so I would continue to run, and I ended up picking up charges that eventually got me into like group homes, juvenile hall, the ranch, California Youth Authority. I've been in that whole system in California.
Were they mostly sex-related charges?
Oh, no, none of them. None of them. I'm 43 years old, so whenever I was a teenager, people just didn't realize that that kind of stuff was going on. And so more of the time it would be like petty theft or under the influence.
And then how did sex trafficking then escalate for you as an adult?
Well, I was in Memphis working in a strip bar, and I met this guy who sold me a dream. He fed me crack, and then one day I owed him. And that's whenever he trafficked me across the United States.
Did he stay with you, or were you just sort of...
Oh, no, he was there with me and four other women.
Did you try to get out?
Yeah, I ran away a few different occasions. I can remember one distinct time, though. We were in Memphis. I ran away. I went to El Paso, Texas, and I was working at the Red Parrot, and I came off stage, and there he was. And that was when my reality kind of clicked in, that it was going to be really, really hard to get away from him if he's going to come four or five states over to get me. That's when the reality kind of set in that, man, this dude really believes that he owns me.
And was he abusive?
Very much so. I have a roadmap in my head. I didn't really realize I had a roadmap in my head until after I went through breast cancer and I lost all my hair, and I seen all the scars that were on my head. And a lot of the reason why I wasn't able to get help is whenever we'd get beat, instead of going to the hospital, we'd just get our head put under cold water until the bleeding would stop.
And you say we, so you weren't alone in this.
Oh, no, sir. Not at all.
How did you get out?
He brought me here to Nashville, Tennessee, and I met this guy that he kind of digged me, and so I kind of told him what to do to help me get out. And so what he did is he went to the pimp and told him that I chose up, that I had given him money. And it's pimps kind of got their own law. And so the pimp couldn't do nothing but respect what was going on. But I got a really bad beating as my going away present. And so since 96, I've been out of that life. But I have to say, it's sad. But I ended up staying out on the streets for probably 7 more years after that, continuing to traffic myself because of my addiction.
Lindsay Robertson, let me ask you, Assistant District Attorney in New Hanover County, about these new laws in North Carolina and what exactly they were meant to address.
Hey, yeah, thanks. And I think, you know, it goes to Sheila's point of her story, even though what started happening to her was a very long time ago. It's very much so what we're seeing today in the sex trafficking arena, especially with girls and boys who had prior sexual abuse before the commercial sexual exploitation began. It's very common. And so one of the reasons for starting this law was recognizing that girls and boys at 15, 16, 17 years old who are getting into the life of being trafficked, in North Carolina, the age of consent is 16. And so these minors could be charged with prostitution. And just like Sheila's experience, be put in juvenile hall, they could be put in jail. And we really want to immunize those minors from charges where they're the victim and not the criminal.
So,
and that's the idea behind safe harbor.
And it does that. What else does the law do?
It increases the penalties for the people who are facilitating the crimes. So for the traffickers, and as Sheila mentioned, the pimps and the Johns, the people who are really driving the demand for the commercial exploitation, it increases the penalties there. Prior to the law, pimping in North Carolina was a misdemeanor. But starting on October 1st, it will be a felony. And then one of the other big things it does in really trying to be more victim-centered in our approach to this crime across the country and certainly in our state is allowing women who are charged with prostitution over the age of 18 really an opportunity to get out of that life. And so across the state in all 100 counties, they'll have to institute what we call a deferred prosecution program. And that means that you've been charged with a crime, but in lieu of being prosecuted for it, we're going to defer your prosecution. We're going to give you an opportunity for counseling, for vocational assessment, and if needed, that chemical dependency assessment to really try to address the underlying issues that lead one to be involved in that exploitation to begin with.
Sheila Simpkins, maybe you can tell us about Magdalen. It sounds like it's one of those programs that you might be going to in lieu of sentencing. Can you tell us about Magdalen?
Well, what she was just talking about here in Nashville, that's like already been kind of set up. We have like the Hannah's Project here. It's for when you get arrested for prostitution, instead of being convicted, you go do a day of different classes and you get tested and stuff. But then you also have the Magdalen program, which is a 2-year residential program for women who have survived trafficking, prostitution, and addiction. And let me say that it's a free program for the women to come and get all of their needs taken care of for the 2 years. And it focuses on taking care of the broken child. We focus on everything that led us to the streets in the first place, because I have not met one woman who, as a child, their dream was to grow up and want to sell theirself, you know. And so they focus on everything that led us to the streets in the first place. And, of course, we do implement the 12-step program into it. It takes care of your physical, your emotional, your spiritual, and then financial needs. And that's where Thistle Farms was created for the women of Magdalen, because we come in with a record and a lot of people don't want to give us a chance. And so Thistle Farms was founded in 2001 as a social enterprise for the women of Magdalen so that they could have work and then be able to save their money. So when the 2 years comes, they're able to transition into their own homes.
Lindsay, it sounds like this legislation now in North Carolina is the first step in understanding the kind of systemic industrial nature of prostitution. It seems to be treated as a kind of a street crime when, in fact, there's a whole – this is quite an industry with its own rules, codes of conduct. If you can talk about choosing up and getting out, choosing your own pimp, getting beat out, sounds like there's quite – quite a system. Is this the first step in recognizing the kind of, well, what I would call systemic and industrial quality of this? And am I right in that?
Well, I think, you know, we talk about, it's sort of becoming more popular to talk about sex trafficking. It's sort of one of the issue du jour. But the reality is, like, for Sheila is a great example that this has been going on for a very long time. And like you mentioned, we're just beginning to pull the surface back. And most of these crimes are hidden beneath the surface or hidden in plain sight, just like the scars on Sheila's head. I mean, unless you really remove the exterior of what's going on, we're never going to get to the root issue here. So, yes, the idea of safe harbor is that we begin to be more victim-centered in our prosecutions and our investigations and focus more on the offender's behavior, because I think as a community, as a society, we're much more likely to focus on what she did wrong and why didn't she leave and what's her problem and why did she become involved in this, as opposed to why did this exploiter, offender, trafficker, pimp, John, why did they target that vulnerable girl or boy? Why were they going after the least of these? And so really beginning to shift our focus away from this idea that we should be prosecuting the supply and instead going right to the demand, because as you mentioned, it's an industry, $32 billion a year that sex trafficking makes people globally. I mean, that's huge. You know, I mean, that's right behind drug trafficking and very quickly catching up with drug trafficking, because once I sell a drug, it's gone. If I have a girl in my stable, to use the pimp's language, if I have several in my stable, that's a renewable resource. And I can replace them, they're fungible, and if they get arrested and they're put in jail, I can very quickly recruit another abandoned or, as Sheila mentioned, throwaway youth. In fact, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children tells us that within 48 hours of running away, one in three teenagers will be sexually commercially exploited. And that's just a staggering number. And according to the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, that's a conservative estimate.
What are the statistics? You talked about $32 billion industry globally. What, give us the scope of the problem in North Carolina.
Right. And you mentioned this a little bit in your introduction. I mean, in North Carolina, we have tons of highways and byways that intersect. We have proximity to what we think of as East Coast hubs for sex trafficking and also labor trafficking. We have Atlanta, we have Charlotte, we have D.C., and we have people being run up and down I-95 as in what I think of as the flesh trade, just as we've historically seen it as a drug freeway. So that's a really big issue there. You mentioned military, and certainly never to blame the military, but anytime you have an increased presence or an increased demand for adult entertainment, the strip clubs, you're going to have an increased demand and accordingly an increased supply of the below-board prostitution and exploitation that's going to be coming alongside of that. Then, as you mentioned, you know, we're a port state. We have a lot of people who travel here for business, especially here in the southeastern region. When people hear the term sex tourism, they think about Thailand, they think about Cambodia, they think about people traveling to have sex with minors to other countries. But the reality is, I frequently see in my job men that are coming into our region traveling for business and going up into a hotel, going online and ordering food for dinner and ordering a girl for entertainment, because it's just that easy.
Is there a difference, Lindsay, between the domestic trade and global trade? Does it look different? Does it operate differently?
I think it does to some extent. I mean, I think you have to look culturally at which global trade you're looking at. When I worked in New York representing foreign-born victims, so women who'd been born in other countries and trafficked into America, those girls oftentimes were kidnapped as children and then trafficked across interstate borders and ultimately into New York City, where I represented them. What you're looking at more domestically is girls, like Sheila mentioned, who the estimate is that 90% of them were sexually abused prior to the commercial exploitation. And so a very, very vulnerable population that when someone comes along, these pimps who, mind you, have actually read books about how to be pimps and how to set up these pimp laws and how they should maintain and sustain their business with these girls, it doesn't take a lot for these girls to become beholden to these pimps, whether that's through drugs. But really, even more simply, when you've got someone who was abused as a child, the grooming process is very easy. They pick them up from high school. They tell them they love them. They buy them nice things. They take them out on their first, you know, quote, date before they ever take them out on their first date with a John. So the girl begins to feel that she loves him and he loves her. And it's the first person that's ever paid her any attention as a girl. It's the first person who's ever said, I'll stick by you no matter what. And it just becomes staggeringly simple for these guys to control these girls' bodies because they're controlling their minds.
Sheila Simpkins, what were the biggest challenges for you when you finally broke away?
Well, I mean, really, it was just learning how to live, you know, because, like, whenever I finally hit my bottom, let me just say that whenever I went into the Magdalene program, I did not go into that program trying to get my life back, okay, because I had never had a life. I was just basically trying to learn how to live. I needed to know how to live because everything up until then was a mess. In today's society, things have changed so much since I was a teenager. You know, if this was out in the open back then, I probably would have been able to get more help. But now it's so much more dangerous because a lot of it's on internet, you know, and so it's harder to actually find help for the girls and boys.
What's your life like now, Sheila?
Well, I mean, in December I will have my bachelor's in psychology. I work for an organization called End Slavery Tennessee, where I'm an intervention specialist, I get to work with teenagers who have been trafficked, and we also go into like group homes and stuff and do prevention groups where we teach them the signs of what a pimp looks like. My life is just really, really great. You know, I'm married. I got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. Of course, I've been working at the Magdalene program since I graduated, so I've been there for 7 years, and so I kind of look at myself as like a light.
Well,
one light out of a lot of lights in America who are just trying to have a voice to let these girls and boys know that there is a way out.
No, congratulations.
We don't have to live like that.
Congratulations, and thank you for sharing your story. Sheila Simpkins, assistant resident manager at Magdalene and a recovery program for Nashville sex victims, and Lindsay Robertson, assistant district attorney at New Hanover County. Thank you both, and thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.